Happy New Year, everybody at the Compass Church. I'm thinking of all of you at our South Naperville campus, everybody at Bolingbrook, Wheaton, Hobson. You know, all of us are moving in to the palace this winter. You know, the heart here of the winter, January and February, we're entering an eight-week series where we are going to meet the kings who lived in the palace of Jerusalem. You ready for that? This palace was amazing. You should know it was built by Solomon. Solomon was an incredible builder. In fact, you may be aware of Solomon's temple. He wanted to build a house for God, and he built an amazing, legendary house for God. Though I would tell you this detail. It took 7 years for him to build a house for God. It took him 13 years to build a house for himself. The palace was bigger and better than the temple was. And it's this palace at Solomon built we're going to move in because we want to meet the kings who ruled out of that house. There were 19 of them, and the Bible describes them, 19 kings, descendants of Solomon who lived in that palace. We don't have time to meet all 19 of them. The series is 8 weeks, and we're doing one per week. And so you say, well, then how are you deciding? I'll tell you how. First of all, I decided not to do the two most popular kings after Solomon. They would be Hezekiah and Josiah. The reason I'm skipping them, first of all, Hezekiah, because I already did a whole series on Hezekiah. Admittedly, it was a long time ago. It was 2014, a series called Awakening, and it's online. If you're wanting to get to know Hezekiah, you can go on our website and tap into that series because it's still there. Josiah also deserves a whole series on him. And so someday in the days ahead, I'm going to do a series on Josiah. So we're skipping those two. But we're going to study eight kings who I'm guessing you've never heard of before. You know, they're strangers to you. And yet, as you get to know them, friends, their life lesson, what God teaches us through them, is pure gold. Has the potential to revolutionize our lives. That's a big statement, but I believe it, and I'm praying that's exactly what happens. You say, who are these eight? Well, I'm glad you asked. Friends, in the seat back in front of you, you will find a card. I encourage everybody to take one of them. It's a card that looks like this, and it's just a Bible bookmark, or put it where you want, but it just reminds you of the eight kings that ruled out of Jerusalem that we're going to study together. And my guess is, as you look over those names, you're like, yeah, no idea who they are. You'll notice I've got a little key where I have symbols that just give you a quick glimpse. Some of them were good. Some of them were evil. Some of them started evil and went good. Others started good and crashed. And that just gives you a little glimpse of that. But these eight kings are going to become friends. And folks, their stories are going to be very precious and life-altering to us. And the first one is this guy by the name of Rehoboam. And I want to study him with you. And so I turn, and actually you'll see texts varying quite a bit. Let me tell you about the text. You may be aware, but if you're not, in the Old Testament there are two accounts of the kings. One of the accounts, just rolling through all the kings, is a series of four books. It's 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, all right? The second account is 1 and 2 Chronicles, and it's an account of the same period, same people, just a different perspective on them, and so as a result, we're going to use both accounts. Today, I want to start in 1 Kings, chapter 11, last few verses of chapter 11. It says, Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all of Israel for 40 years. Then he rested with his ancestors, which is a nice way to say he died, and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, there's our guy, Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. I should clarify, Solomon, the dad of Rehoboam, was the last king of the United Kingdom. We're about to see that Rehoboam causes a split through much of the account of the kings. There's a divided kingdom. It's called Israel to the north, and the southern kingdom is called Judah. But before Rehoboam broke it up, by what he did. It was united. Now, it was a very short united kingdom. Only three kings reigned over the united kingdom of Israel. They were, Saul was the first, and then David, who you probably have heard of, David's son Solomon, who we've already mentioned. Those three were the only kings over the united kingdom. And under Rehoboam, and let's find out why. It says that on this day, he became king. Can you imagine the heady experience that was? Rehoboam was blown away by the power that came his way. Power, authority. How do you feel about authority? You know, I want to talk about a symbol of power for just a moment, and I want to find the symbol on a dime. Here's a dime. Do you ever look at the back of your dime? Here's a picture of what the back of the dime looks like. There's a torch on the back. I don't know if you ever noticed this detail. The torch on the dime is a bundle of sticks all strapped together. And you say, I wonder why that is. I'll tell you why that is. It's a subtle adaptation of an earlier dime. Before 1946, our dimes looked like this. Some of you are old enough to remember when dimes were like that. And you see here, too, a bundle of sticks, only it's not a torch here. It's actually, see that axe blade coming off? This is called a phasis. The phasis was an ancient Roman symbol for authority. I got one here. And the phasis was very popular with the Romans and then very popular with Americans. The Lincoln Memorial's got phasis on it. The statues of George Washington, paintings around D.C. and our dime. And you say, why is it a symbol of authority? Why was Rehoboam entrusted with this authority? I'll tell you why it was a symbol of authority. Ready for this? Because it represented both corporal and capital punishment. Some of you saw it. The rods were to symbolize this. That's the corporal punishment. Essentially, I'm in charge. I'm the king. And if you don't obey me, my minions will take these rods and beat you within an inch of your life. And if that didn't work, they'd say, my minion will come and take the axe and chop off your head if you don't obey me. Authority. Isn't that a beautiful thing? You know, in our culture, increasingly, people have a problem with authority. People are like, what Rehoboam received that day, this authority is an ugly thing. You know, some are like, everybody should bug out and let each person run their own life, and there should be no one telling anyone else what to do. The reason I believe that we hate authority in our culture increasingly is because people have abused authority. We see it displayed in our country and ways that were not how God created it. God did create authority. Do you know that? This was his idea. But he designed it to be beautiful. And what we're going to see here with Rehoboam is how it could be and how it was. And we're going to learn a lot about wielding authority. You say, why do I need to learn about wielding authority? I'm never going to be king. You're right. You won't be king. But you'll have authority. Everybody does at some point. I was just thinking about the various venues of life. You know, at work, maybe at your job, you've been entrusted with a subordinate, someone to lead. Or maybe at school, you know, there are teachers and coaches that have been entrusted with authority. At home, parents have authority over their children. At church, you want authority? We'll give you authority. We need leaders, son. We have ministries and teams and small groups that need leaders. And so, friends, at various points in your life, we're all entrusted with authority. And the question is, what type of a leader will you be? What type of philosophy of leadership do you operate with? That's a question that the people of Israel had for Rehoboam. They said, now that you've got authority, how will you lead? And here's them asking that question. This is found in verse 3 of the next chapter, 1 Kings 12, 3 and 4. The whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father, Solomon, put a heavy yoke on us, But now, lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. In this statement, the people are commenting, criticizing how his dad led. They said, man, your dad was ruthless. He put a heavy yoke, a heavy burden on us, and it's true. In one sense, Solomon's day was the glory days. Israel was wealthy, or at least the capital was, and new buildings, temple and palace, and everybody was amazed. But here's the truth of it. All of his, Solomon's, advance was on the shoulders of people he abused and used through taxation and forced labor. Solomon was a leader of the type who was so authoritarian, so demanding, that the people were burnt out and spent. And as there's a transition of leadership here to his son, Rehoboam. Maybe they were hoping, maybe they saw something in Rehoboam that was different. When they say this, hey, you know how your dad led. We're asking you, don't be like him. Lead without the harsh edge. Lead with some compassion and sensitivity to we, your subjects. And they promise, if you do, we will follow you wholeheartedly. They're essentially saying, tell us your leadership philosophy. Now, Rehoboam doesn't answer them right away. He actually asks for 3 days so he can seek some counsel on this. That's a wise move. This is a very important decision. Let me read verse 6. Then Rehoboam, King Rehoboam, consulted the elders who served his father Solomon during his lifetime. These guys are consultants. How would you advise me to answer these people? Look at how they respond in verse 7. This is beautiful. These wise men replied, if today you will be a servant, how should you lead? By being a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer. Favorable answer. Remember, they had said, hey, don't be harsh with us like your dad. So give them an answer of, I won't be harsh. I will show compassion. He says, if you lead that way, they will always be your servants. What a beautiful statement. These wise, wise men say, you want to know how to lead, Rehoboam? Here's how. As a servant. Servant leadership. I find it ironic that servant leadership's a bit of a buzzword in leadership circles and consultant and business centers. And often you'll hear that Robert Greenleaf, back in 1970, he's the founder of servant leadership. And I want to go, no, he's not. 3,000 years ago, the consultants of Rehoboam and Solomon were speaking about servant leadership then. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ was an inspiring proponent of servant leadership. Can I show you when Jesus taught it? Here's Mark 10, verse 42. Jesus said to his followers, you know that the rulers in this world, they flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, my people, it's going to be different. Whoever wants to be a leader must be a servant. And then Jesus not only talked about it, he modeled it. Here's at the very end of his life, John 13, verse 3. Jesus knew that the Father had given him authority. There's the authority to lead. Given him authority over everything. And so he got up from the table, wrapped a towel around his waist, poured water in a basin, and began to wash his disciples' feet. With this moment of epiphany and realization of the magnitude of authority that Jesus had, he says, I'll show you how to use authority. I'm going to be a servant. And friends, that's the key. Let's go to the next verse, verse 7. When he says, be a servant, servant leadership is different than normal, common leadership. Common leadership is driven by selfish motives. Is I gotta be successful and profitable and I'm gonna win. And it's self. And servant leadership says, I care about those I lead even more than profitability. And I'm gonna be considerate and kind and loving, firm when necessary, but I am going to bless and help them succeed. That's servant leadership. It's a very different leadership philosophy. And these guys wisely direct Rehoboam to this leadership approach. But it doesn't get received very well. Verse 8, but Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him, and he consulted the young men who had grown up with him. He's like, thanks, old man. That was an interesting approach. I think I need more advice. Anybody else got an idea on how I should lead? Hey, buddies, what do you guys think? And look at how they advise him. Verse 10, they replied, oh, so these people have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us. Please make it lighter. Now you tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I'll make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I'll scourge you with scorpions. What are his friends saying? His friends are saying, hey, listen, Rehoboam, this is an important moment. They're wanting to figure out what you're made of. They think you're weak. They think you're a pushover. Buddy, you got to rise up. Look them in the eye. Let them know you are presidential, that you got what it takes, that you will not be pushed around. We hear that kind of advice, don't we? And Rehoboam has a decision to make. What counsel will he follow? Look at verse 12. The people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said to them, come back to me in 3 days. And the king answered, here's his official response. The king answered the people harshly, rejecting the advice given him by the elders. He followed the advice of the young men. He says, I understand servant leadership. Sounds like, you know, a bunch of wimpy stuff to me. I'm choosing the more traditional authoritarian approach to leadership. And friends, that decision had a huge consequence. When I say consequence, look at this, verse 16. When all Israel saw that the king had refused to listen to them, they answered the king, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? What does that mean? Jesse's son was David, and Rehoboam is the grandson of David. And they're saying, in a sense, your lineage, we have no part of it. You should know this was a historic succession slogan. Whenever the people wanted to break away from the kingship, they'd say, we have no part in David. The reason was that David was unusual in his kingship in that he was not a son of the successor, Saul. Saul, everybody anticipated that Jonathan, his son, was going to be king. But because of David's popularity and slaying Goliath and stuff, there was a shift and a new family took over. And some would say David's rule was illegitimate. You know, he wasn't following the right family lineage. And so people had called for succession to break away from David. And that's what's happening here. That same old succession slogan. What part do we have in David? They're essentially saying, we're not going to follow you, Rehoboam. And the beautifully united nation split. In fact, look at verse 19. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this very day. From this moment on, when you read the Bible, there are two kingdoms. There's the north, which is called Israel, made of 10 of the 12 tribes. And then the kingdom to the south, where Jerusalem was, which was called Judah. Now, technically, it was two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. But that beautiful unity was destroyed. And you want to say, yeah, I've always seen that divided kingdom in the Bible. How did that come about? Leadership philosophy. How you steward authority. That's how it came about. It came about with this guy, Rehoboam. And the day he was entrusted with authority and his decision to take a pass on servant leadership and to take the traditional authoritarian approach instead. Boom! Blew up the nation. And it will blow up our lives and our society as well. And so, friends, we really need to understand the power and importance of servant leadership. You know, to just elaborate on this, I want to get scientific for a bit and tell you about some of the findings of a professor. His name is Dr. Keltner. Here's a picture of him. He is a psychologist and a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's really focused his energies on authority and specifically the influence that authority has on the person who bears it. and then how people are influenced by varying uses of authority. One of his studies, I found this fascinating. He started just at the freshman dorm at Berkeley. He went to a freshman and he interviewed them and he said, "Hey, who is most popular in your dorm?" In other words, who is really respected and who have the freshmen just naturally given power to? You know, the one who's highest in that popularity chart tends to be the people who are respected and powerful. And then tell me about them. And to his surprise, he found out that the ones who were popular were those who were considerate and agreeable, kind, loving, nice. And he found out that people tend to assign authority to those they like. And one of his conclusions was that when it comes to gaining authority, he finds that it's people who treat people well, people who are loving, kind, considerate. But then, he says, what's mind-boggling is that those very people who are so kind and considerate, once they've got authority in their arms for a time, they lose those very considerate traits that got them there in the first place. There's something about having authority that corrupts you. He says it like this. He said, "Surveys of organizations find that the vast majority of rude and inappropriate behavior, such as shouting profanities, they come from the offices of those who have the most authority. These people flirt inappropriately, tease in hostile fashion, and become totally impulsive. The very traits that helped these leaders accumulate power in the first place all but disappear once they have the power. Instead of being polite, honest, and kind, they become impulsive, reckless, and rude. They morph into monsters." Isn't that sad? Even the most virtuous people can be undone by the corner office. You know, we say power corrupts, and that's essentially what it's getting at. And friends, it's true. And I don't need to convince you of that. I think as you even look at some leaders in politics and leaders in business and leaders in sports and leaders in the church, they're behaving badly. And it begs the question, why? Why is this power corrupting? I'm asking this question. I'll be honest with you. In the church world, maybe you're aware, there have been some prominent Chicago pastors who have been found out to be behaving badly. And it's not, you know, escaping me that I too have been entrusted with a measure of authority in my leadership position. And I know that I too could experience this same dynamic, though, you know, Jeff may have started as a kind and loving guy. It doesn't need to continue that way. In fact, the trajectory turns in the wrong direction. And I invite you, we are in a leadership crisis in our society and in need of people who understand this corrosive capacity of authority and have learned by the power of God how not to take the route of Rehoboam. And how do we do that? Well, here, Professor Keltner has a little bit of insight as to what's behind the problem. And he writes this: people with lots of authority tend to, and he's a psychologist, remember, he can say this. People with lots of authority tend to behave like neurological patients with a damaged frontal lobe, a brain area that is crucial for empathy. They seem to lose their capacity to be empathetic. He goes on, "The main problem with power is that it tends to make us less sympathetic to the concerns and emotions of others. We lose our capacity to connect and feel, care about others." He's actually demonstrated this scientifically. He did a study of eye contact, and he measured, you know, various people in various positions of authority and how much eye contact they give. And the lowest category was when people of high authority were speaking with folks with little authority. He found that those people with authority gave very little eye contact to the one they were told to converse with, as if to say, you know, why do I want to talk to you? You don't matter. You don't deserve my attention. That's sad. Here's another test. They asked people to write a capital E on their forehead. And he found that the ones who wrote it backward the most were consistently those with the most authority. And when I say backwards, a capital E, meaning they wrote it backwards with perspective of someone who's looking at their forehead. Not backwards from their perspective. You know, if you're in their brain looking out, that's the way an E should be written. And he said, people with high authority tend to be unable to see the world through the eyes of another. They're so myopic and self-centered in their approach. You're like, this is depressing. I know, I'm feeling it, friends. I am like, wow, Lord, don't let this happen to me. And I'm like, God, help us follow Jesus. But we need help because this pull down to an ugly route is so strong when authority's been placed in your hands. And I think God gives us, I know God gives us some wisdom in what the elders said to Rehoboam. He didn't take their advice, but we're gonna. Let's look at it again. I want to go back to verse 7 here and point out a redundancy that kind of bothered me at first. Did you see this redundancy? He says, today, if you'll, let's highlight this. Be a servant to these people and serve them. Doesn't that kind of seem to say the same thing twice? And then I even looked at the Hebrew that's behind. Sure enough, it's the same word, different versions of the same word. But then it dawned on me, no, there's two things. One of them is how you view yourself, who you are, be a servant to these people. And the other is what you do, serve them. And so two things. One, how you see yourself in relation to other people. And the second, how you treat and what you do other people. Here, I have these words that are helpful to me, and I offer them for your consideration. The first is rethink value. And by value, I mean how you value people. Rethink how you value people. The tendency in our society is to say, if I've got more authority than you, I'm more important than you. I'm more valuable than you. I'm a very important person. We use that VIP terminology. And yet, according to the ways of God, we shouldn't be that way. That just because someone has low levels of authority entrusted to them makes them no less important. In fact, this be a servant to them. If you've got people under your authority, meaning you've got more authority than they, rather than you saying, they're my servant, you should say, I'm your servant. I view you not as a someone who doesn't matter, but as a VIP. I view you as royalty, and to be in your presence is an honor. That's rethinking how you value people, isn't that? And friends, this is one of the keys. Unfortunately, with authority, and I'm just going to describe it in all of its ugliness, sometimes people are like, man, you got to understand, I am very important. My time, my energy, my attention really matters, and yours not so much. I don't have time for you. Isn't that terrible? But rather, we should recognize this dynamic and say, I'm not going there. We should practice, and I try practicing this. I would challenge you to do as much. Lord, I'm going to rethink value. How valuable are people as I go about my day? I'm going to find folks who maybe the world would say are less valuable than I, and I'm going to say, that's not true. They are priceless and precious, and I'm going to look them in the eye and give them the attention they deserve. You know, I'm going to find folks who are in service-related roles, and I'm not going to, you know, hey, bust my table. No, I want to engage with them and celebrate them. I'm going to find folks who are recent immigrants and aren't speaking English yet well, and man, I'm going to treasure them as the VIPs. Every single person was created in the image of God. Jesus Christ came to die for their sins. You have not met an individual who was not mind-blowingly precious to God. I'm going to interact with a little toddler and give them the attention they deserve as someone so precious. Friends, I challenge you. Say, Lord, give me your eyes as I interact with people this day and help me to see the unspeakable value in everybody I come across. That's one of the keys to winning this battle. And here's the second, rethink value. Got another V, rethink victory. What does victory look like? Well, what is success? You know, sometimes, you know, we say, well, victory is profitability, growth of the church or of the department or of the business. And according to this passage, what we're to be striving for is to serve them, that victory is love. Victory is loving, serving those you lead. And now, am I saying that profitability and growth don't matter? No, they do matter. But to a believer who's adopted the philosophy of Jesus of servant leadership, those things don't matter as much as love does. When you get to the end of your life, you want to be able to look back and say, more than how profitable was my department, I want to celebrate, man, the people under my lead, I loved on them. I cared for them. I listened to them. I served them. I helped them. I helped them flourish. That was my objective. Now, the irony is people are like, man, if you take the eye off of profitability and growth, and if you make all this lovey, be kind to people stuff your focus, you're going to fail. Just the opposite. They find that with servant leadership comes in a surprising measure of profitability and growth. And so, for your consideration, these days I am saying, Lord, victory and value, victory and value. My victory is not building this big church, but it is serving and loving on those I lead. And value, Lord, as I interact with people, I'm not going to fall into the trap that I matter more than they because I'm higher ranking. I'm going to see everybody, no matter how young or old, powerful or weak, rich or poor. I'm going to see everybody as priceless because that's how you see them, Lord. Friends, and I think by this wisdom applied, we can avoid that dark corruption of the heart that comes often to those wielding authority. Let me finish with just a positive story, a story of victory, a fun conversation I'll never forget. I was talking with a spiritual seeker. In fact, that's why I was talking to the guy, because he wasn't a Christian, and he wanted to meet with someone who could answer questions about Jesus. Yeah. And so he and I were talking, and I wanted to get to know him, so I asked, hey, where do you work? And he told me the name of this company he had worked for many years. And then I got all excited, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to name drop here. I do that. That's not good. But my rationale is that I am actually friends with the CEO of the company that he works for. He and I, the CEO, served on this board, and a friendship was born out of that context. And so, this is fun. Now, this is a huge company, over 20,000 employees. And this spiritual seeker I was talking to was in a very entry-level, low-ranking position. So I knew that he's probably never met the CEO of his company, but he's heard of him, and the fact that I know him is going to be pretty impressive. So I said to him, I'm like, hey, yeah, I know that company. I go, in fact, your CEO is a good friend of mine. You know, isn't that arrogant? I know. And right as I said it, to my shock, he said, my CEO is a very good friend of mine. That deflated me. I mean, my whole purpose there was lost. I'm like, what do you mean he's a good friend of yours? And he went on to explain. He said, Jeff, it's weird. He goes, a huge company. We have multiple campuses. Well, just so happens that I work at the same campus as the CEO. And the many buildings on the campus, but it just so happens that I work in the same building as the CEO. And it just so happens that every morning as the CEO walks to his office, he takes a path that goes by my cubicle. And years back, he started saying hi to me every morning. And then he asked my name, and he remembered my name. And then he stopped and talked to me one day. And now every day he stops, not long, just a few minutes, but we chat. And he talks to me about my family and gets updates on my kids and my interests and what I'm doing and my good times and my bad. He went on to explain. He goes, I've gone through some real dark times and been honest with him about them. And his wisdom, encouragement, and support has been precious to me. He goes, he's a good friend of mine. And I was like, wow. I mean, no offense to CEOs in the room, but normally when you get a CEO of a large company like that, they have been so thoroughly corrupted by authority that they just don't act compassionate, particularly to lower-ranking folks like that. And you may say, but Jeff, that's... that's not realistic. If he's got over 20,000 people that he's leading, he can't be that way to everybody. You're right, he can't. But the fact that he is to this one person reveals his heart. And I happen to have talked with some of his direct reports, and they all say the same. This is the best boss I have ever had. His concern for me, his desire to see me flourish is so evident that I love working for this guy. And you say, well, how did he get that way? You should know he is a devout Christ follower and has been taught servant leadership from Jesus himself. That's how he gets it. And I give this positive example only to remind us that the sad story of Rehoboam cannot, should not be ours. We are in a need these days of leaders who will shine with a compassion, a character, a kindness, a love, a devotion to people over profit that just is so rare. We're in a leadership crisis in our culture, and may the solution arise out of the people of the Compass Church, out of the people of the Kingdom of Jesus Christ, as we follow our Master in servant leadership. Shall we pray? Jesus, thank you for not only teaching servant leadership. Jesus, thank you for showing us the way, thinking of you with that towel around your waist, washing your disciples' feet. It's inspiring. Thinking of you, you reminded us, Jesus, that I have come not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. Christ, we love that our King, Jesus Christ, you, our King, are a servant leader to the nth degree. And would you teach us to be likewise? Please, God, we beg that your Spirit and your truth would guide us, and that when we're given authority, that we wouldn't be corrupted. Help us always value every person, no matter what position they might have in the world system. And help us remember that victory is seen in love and treating people well. Please, God, teach us to live and to lead like Jesus. We pray this in his name. Amen.